This is Jeff Blankford welcoming you to the November 12th edition of Takes on the World, a public affairs program that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to you, our listeners. In the aftermath of almost every one of our national elections, I think how Abe Lincoln got it wrong. You recall his famous saying, "You can fool all the people some of the time and some of the people all the time, but you can't fool all the people all the time." What Abe didn't understand was that you don't have to fool all the people all the time. You just have to fool enough of the time. Or as H.L. Mencken put it more directly, nobody ever went broke underestimating the intelligence of the American people. That's my take on last week's elections, in which Americans, with barely a murmur, allowed the corporate money bags to once again have their way with the American public in ways that would be illegal in any other developed country. At 20 minutes past the hour, I plan to bring you a perspective on those elections from within one of those developed countries, Italy. I hope to be speaking then with former ABC correspondent Charles Glass about that, but more importantly about an article of his just published in the New York Review of Books on Syria and his efforts to raise funds to build a statue honoring Edward Snowden, Julian Assange, and Chelsea Manning, three heroes of our times. Yesterday, of course, was Veterans Day, what used to be called Armistice Day, to celebrate the day in the month when the guns of World War I fell silent. The appropriate messages were delivered in our media and by our public officials and former generals who in solemn tones praised those who had made the ultimate sacrifice in the service of our country, while the families of those who had fallen in current and past wars visited the nation's military cemeteries to remember and pay their respects. To be sure, no one, at least publicly, questioned what service to the nation was provided by any of America's wars or foreign adventures since the end of World War II, and it would have been surprising as well as and not considered good form had anyone done so. In particular, as in the campaigning by both parties during the midterm elections, there was no questioning by the pundits or the politicians or any demand by the public for an accounting of the trillions of dollars spent by both the Bush and Obama administrations in pursuing what clearly has become a war without end in the Middle East. By now, we have come to expect nothing but hypocrisy from our politicians, and those who wave the flag often turn out to be the most hypocritical. Take, for example, their silence in response to a front-page story in the New York Times on October 15th by reporter C.J. Chivers. It described how chemical weapons from the 1980s, long ago abandoned by Saddam Hussein's army and unidentifiable as such, had released their deadly contents when the weapons caches in which they were embedded were destroyed by U.S. troops in Iraq between 2003 and 2011. The initial Times article mentioned only 17 known cases, but as the story became more widely known among vets, more than 600 have since come forward to say that they too had been exposed to sarin and mustard gas. It wasn't something that the Pentagon wanted to hear, and consequently, despite their obvious symptoms, the infected soldiers were in numerous instances denied medical evacuation and hospital treatment in the United States. The problem for Washington was that many of these dangerous chemicals had been provided by the United States to Saddam when he was an ally in fighting Iran and inserted into weapons and factories built in Iraq by German construction firms. One of the soldiers interviewed by the New York Times told how his supervisors ordered a cover-up. Quote, "They put a gag order on all of us, the security detail, us, the clinic, everyone. We were briefed to tell family members that we were exposed to industrial chemicals because our case was classified top secret," end quote. To date, only one senator has called for these dishonored vets to be taken care of, and War Secretary Chuck Hagel has opened a hotline for vets to contact his department. But as far as I can tell, not a single member of Congress or President Obama has called for the investigation that the situation clearly demands. There are some other vets, now in their 70s and 80s, who know what it is like to be treated shabbily and dishonorably by the country they served and by the flag-waving members of Congress and the American media. They are the veterans, the surviving veterans, of the Navy spy ship the USS Liberty, which was attacked by the Israeli Air Force and Navy in international waters off the Israeli coast on the afternoon of June 8, 1967, on the fourth day of the Six-Day War, leaving 34 sailors dead and 174 injured. flying a huge U.S. flag and well marked as an American vessel that lightly armed Liberty, was first attacked by Israeli aircraft dropping napalm and firing rockets. When Liberty crew members attempted to radio for assistance, they found the Israelis had blocked their transmissions. Eventually, the ship was able to contact the U.S. carrier Saratoga, and 12 fighter jets and 4 tanker planes were dispatched in its defense from 600 miles away. But they never got there. When word of this reached Washington, Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara ordered the planes recalled. When a disbelieving Admiral Geis, commander of the 5th Fleet, called McNamara back to know if President Johnson was aware of his orders, LBJ came on the phone to say it was his decision to call back the planes. According to Admiral Geis, LBJ's words were, "I don't want to embarrass an ally," end quote. To make sure of that, Johnson ordered the Liberty survivors not to speak about the attack to anyone or face court-martial, a fear that lasted until 1979 when Lieutenant Jim Annis, one of the ship's surviving officers upon retiring, published his book Assault on the Liberty. There have been several excellent books on the incident published since, as well as a few films, the most recent on Al Jazeera America 2 weeks ago entitled Israel's Attack on America. It featured interviews with several of those remaining survivors and new evidence proving that the Israeli attack was not a case of Israel having mistaken it for a smaller Egyptian ship, as Israel and its defenders have long claimed. While 45 years later, the survivors are still calling for congressional investigation of the attack, the national media, as well as our alternative news media, continue to protect Israel from criticism on this issue as if LBJ was still alive and giving orders. That's why I would guess that none of you listening to this program had heard about this latest film unless you watch Al Jazeera on cable. Let's turn to the Iranian front. With a deadline of November 24th to complete a deal designed to curtail Iran's nuclear enrichment program, and both the U.S. and Tehran engaged in a war against the Islamic State, or Daesh, as it's called itself in Arabic, President Obama reportedly sent a secret letter last month to Iranian Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, offering to work together against Daesh in exchange for a deal on Tehran's nuclear program. The letter's existence was reported last Thursday by the Wall Street Journal and was sent without informing Israel or other Middle Eastern allies, according to the journal. In the letter, Obama acknowledged a shared interest in working against Daesh, but reportedly said that joint operations against the group could only take place after Tehran and the P5+1 countries reached an agreement on the country's nuclear program. White House spokesman Josh Earnest refused to deny or confirm the report, saying, "I'm not in a position to discuss private correspondence between the president and any world leader, but on the sidelines of the nuclear talk, Iran and the U.S. had discussed the Daesh threat." Incoming Republican leaders have indicated that they will move quickly in January to assure Israel that no deal with Iran will be allowed. South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham, the incoming Senate Appropriations Subcommittee on Foreign Operations Chair, told the Israeli-American Council over the weekend that he will introduce legislation in the Senate that will give that body effective veto power over any nuclear deal reached with Tehran. Graham and incoming Foreign Relations Committee Chair Senator Bob Corker from Tennessee will co-sponsor the bill in January, with Graham vowing to quote-unquote kill any deal that he believes is a bad deal, which means any deal, as Graham has been an opponent of negotiations with Iran and on Middle East issues has essentially functioned as an agent for Israel. Last year, you might recall, if you were listening to Takes on the World, Graham co-sponsored a resolution with Democrat Robert Menendez that called on the U.S. to back up Israel politically, economically, and militarily if it decided to attack Iran over its nuclear weapons program. The resolution passed 99-0. I said, if you were listening, because the vote was not reported in any of our mainstream media, on NPR or on Democracy Now! If you also haven't heard of the Israeli-American Council, you can be forgiven. Originally founded in Los Angeles 7 years ago, it's made up of Israelis who have immigrated to America, who may or may not have become citizens, and now want to add their pro-Israeli voices to those of AIPAC and the Washington Institute for Near East Policy that already dominate Beltway politics on Middle East issues. The organization, in its first national meeting, demonstrated its clout by attracting as speakers former governor and presidential candidate Mitt Romney and ex-Senator Joe Lieberman, besides Graham. The Israeli-American Council won't be lacking for money either, judging from the appearance on stage of major Republican funder Sheldon Adelson and his Democratic counterpart Haim Saban, who is expected to throw many millions behind Hillary Clinton when she announces for the presidency. Last December, I played a clip of Clinton speaking before the Saban Forum at the Brookings Institution, in which she announced that she was one of Haim's Power Rangers, referring to the Japanese children's TV program that Haim Saban bought and made him a multimillionaire several decades ago. What more can an Israeli-American who claims he is a, quote, one-issue man, and that issue is Israel, end quote, want if he has a realistic prospect of owning a U.S. president, and the first woman president at that? Well, there is more. While Adelson and Saban were chatting on stage, they regretted not having bought the Washington Post when it was available instead of letting it go to Amazon's owner Jeff Bezos for a mere $250 million. Here's how Rosie Gray of the BuzzFeed blog described their exchange. Quote, they lamented what they view as an anti-Israel bias in the American media and talked about how easy it would be to buy major newspapers together. Both already have influence with specific news organizations. Adelson owns the Israeli newspaper Israel Hayom, and Saban is chairman of a Spanish-language television station, Univision. Oh, I wish that Jeff Bezos didn't buy the Washington Post because it would have been nice for you and I to have bought it, Sheldon, Saban said. $250 million, bupkis, he stole it. Why don't you and I go after the New York Times, Adelson said. There's only one way to buy it, money, end quote. Well, on a yet more serious note, considering that he will likely be Hillary's major financial backer, Saban said that if he were in the shoes of Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu, in the event of a deal with Iran that he judged to be dangerous for Israel, quote, I would bomb the living daylights out of those sons of bitches, end quote. Not surprisingly, Saban, a major Obama donor in 2012 and Clinton backer in 2008, questioned Obama's policy toward Iran. Quote, at the moment we could have increased the sanctions, we decreased them, and that was a mistake in my view, he said. Saban expressed hope that Graham's proposed bill to kill an Iran deal will pass, adding that, quote, we should have taken some steps to show that we, the United States, mean business, end quote. The military option, Saban said, needs to be, quote, a real option and not lip service. Saban was outraising funds to take care of soldiers the other day, or actually last week, in Beverly Hills, but as in the past, they aren't our soldiers, they're Israel's. The headline in last Friday's Hollywood Variety, the only media to cover the affair, read in bold black type, Haim Saban's Friends of the Israel Defense Forces gala raises record $33 million, end quote. Here's how Variety's associate editor Melina Saval described the scene, quote, the ballroom of the Beverly Hilton was flush with pride at Thursday's Friends of the Israel Defense Forces gala, where billionaire media mogul and fundraising juggernaut Haim Saban inspired some of the biggest names in Hollywood and in the business sector to donate a record-breaking $33 million to the nonprofit organization, which provides educational, social, cultural, and economic services for Israel's soldiers and the families of fallen soldiers. Barbara Streisand, Arnold Schwarzenegger, Sylvester Stallone, Avi Lerner, Pamela Anderson, Ben Silverman, and Chris Tuckett were among the 1,200 guests at the star-studded feat, Saval went on, which featured a gourmet three-course kosher dinner and an emotional reunion between American and Israeli vets brought together through Heroes to Heroes, a philanthropic foundation that funds trips for U.S. soldiers to Israel to help them heal from the devastating effects of war. End quote. I'm not sure that's where I'd want to heal if I was an American soldier. Anyway, the Oracle's Larry Ellison was the evening's biggest contributor, pledging $9 million. And guest founders, Paul and Maurice Marciano, donated $5.2 million during the fundraising portion of the event. In my mind, there's no greater honor than supporting some of the bravest people in the world, said Ellison. And I thank Friends of the Israel Defense Forces for providing us with this opportunity year after year to celebrate and support these soldiers. These men and women come together with indefatigable purpose to defend Israel and strive to coexist in peace, end quote. Barbara Streisand had this to say: this event is always one of the most inspiring and emotional evenings of the year. That they can say this after what the Israel Defense Forces did to Gaza and its people this summer is nothing less than obscene, as is the fact that this fundraiser broke the previous West Coast record by over $10 million. With all those celebrities present and the extraordinary amount of money raised, one would think this would be a story for the major media, at the very least the Los Angeles Times. But it never is. As in the past, with its fundraisers in Beverly Hills and New York's Waldorf Astoria, which traditionally raised far more than a West Coast branch, the Friends of Israel's Defense Forces apparently does not want their fellow Americans to know the amount of tax-exempt dollars they are raising for a foreign army while thousands of U.S. Army vets are homeless in America's streets. I'm going to read you what I wrote about this phenomenon for Counterpunch website on August 13th of last year, after the New York dinner had raised $27 million, and there was not a single mention of the event in the New Yorker national media. Quote, considering that an estimated 870,000 U.S. veterans are suffering the after effects physically and mentally of multiple deployments in Iraq and Afghanistan and comprise a significant segment of the nation's homeless, I wrote at the time, the very existence of the Friends of the Israel Defense Forces and the nature of its primary concern, the welfare of Israeli soldiers, might be viewed as an insult not only to U.S. servicemen and women, but to ordinary Americans who are forced to confront the increasing cost of medicines and medical care, higher gas and food prices, and underfunded schools, not to mention the more than 300,000 who lose their jobs and are forced to file for unemployment benefits every week for the past several decades, end quote. Well, that's one admittedly overlong sentence, but it explains why most Americans outside of the organization's charm circle know nothing about it. The Friends of the Israel Defense Forces obviously has enough clout with the national and local media to make sure its fundraising successes are kept hidden from the public at large.